Working? Good morning, colleagues. It's 11 o'clock, so we'll start the session. Just a few introductions, because I'm not Richard Painter, I'm Phil Metcalf, and I'm chairing the session because Richard can't make it. John Stewart is the rapporteur, and we'll introduce the various speakers and panel members as we go through. The session deals with training of workers, and the scope of presentations is going to cover all types of situations, so normal situations, accident situations. It's going to cover all spheres of application, so medical, industrial, the nuclear industry, the whole thing. There's been a lot of points that are potentially sort of interest in this area, and Renata, in organising the event, suggested maybe we try to focus on four dimensions, which is who basically has the responsibilities for training of people working in radiation environments, what criteria we should use in terms of evaluating the success of our training efforts, what should we do about workers who move from one facility to another, so-called itinerant workers, who has the responsibility for control there, and also the utility of a radiation training passport, similar to a sort of radiation dose passport. So maybe there are some sort of options in that regard. So with that as an introduction, we'll start, and we're going to try and pick out sort of issues in this area. We're trying to pick out also lessons learned, and maybe some direction to the international organisations and other organisations of what the future can be in terms of training. We start off then with a presentation from Shengli Niu from the ILO, who will make a presentation in terms of why it's important for people working in radiation environments to be trained. And he's going to give us an overview from the perspective of the International Labour Organization. Shengli, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd like to thank Renata Zavinsky from the IAEA for taking the leadership in coordinating and organizing this workshop and this seminar. And I know all of you know how important training education. I don't have to, you know, to show you your presence here is a strong indication, but that doesn't mean people who did not participate in this session does not consider training education important. It's simply a priority, a competition of other things. And nobody can argue training education is, in particular for the workers, is not important. So I try to share with you what we from the ILO consider why a radiation protection training education is so important for the workers. You know, when things like this, you have a big explosion and people are killed, huge environmental damage and economic losses, and then safety and health is becoming nowhere and being in the high position of the government agenda or being the headline news on the newspapers and being discussed. But we know safety and health, how can I move? You know, accident, safety and health, if I compare with the iceberg, accidents is those, you know, above the sea, I mean the water, people see that. But under the water, and the workers are exposed to a variety of risk and hazards. So they can be chemical, physical, biological, they can be ergonomic, they can be mechanic, and psychosocial risk factors. So the actually, those which are very visible, they really represent the tip of the iceberg. We have a lot of injuries and diseases and problems at the workplace. So ILO is doing some global estimation on the impact of safety and health. For example, we know worldwide 2.2 billion employed workers, and among them we have about 2.3 million people who die, who are killed each year, either due to fatal accidents or due to occupational diseases. That really means, you know, at the end of this morning session, this 1.5 hours, 4,000 workers will be killed due to the exposure at the workplace. And that's the fatality part, but if you move to the injury part, we have much more people who are injured. For example, the ILO estimate every year we have 370 million people who are injured, and that we're obliged them to be away from work at least from 4 days and more. And if you go to the root causes of accidents can be caused by human errors, unsafe behavior, or can be caused by technical faults or external forces. And this morning there's a session of Fukushima. Fukushima is really caused or triggered by external force, or it's really a human error or human a failure. And we believe that you know, through the statistic analysis and research, so we know 90% of all accidents at a workplace, they are caused by human error. And talking about safe and health at a workplace, you know, occupational accidents are all preventable. So therefore, the employer has a duty or obligation to make sure the hazard is being evaluated and the risk is being managed and appropriate action being taken. So it is really the responsibility of the employers to provide workers with a safe and healthy working environment. So this is one of the most important basic principles in occupational safety and health. But we cannot only rely on the good view of the employer. So the government really has a role to play to make sure there are rules established and the rules are being enforced. When we talk about workers, if an accident happens, then people often blame the workers to say, you did not follow the safety instructions, you did not do your work properly. So yes, the workers have a duty to cooperate with the employers to fulfill the employer's obligation for safety and health, but they have to comply with the safety instructions. But they do have a right, the right to information, right to be educated, the right to have, you know, to be appropriately instructed. And if they have not been trained or educated properly, they can't do their work properly. So they do have a right, and that is often neglected. So that is one of the very important principles, the basic rights of the workers. The workers really have the right to know and to participate in all the safety and health measures in the workplace. We know large people, our workforce, they are exposed to occupational radiation, to radiation, ionizing radiation. And this is the figure from the UNSCR. We have 2.2 million people whose occupational exposure is being monitored. But how we can train those people, the economic crisis, the competition of the market, and the employment pattern has changed. There's an increased trend of labor flexibility. And before we have fixed permanent staff members and they work for the company and they have been trained and you can keep them. But now the work has been contracted and given to other people and you don't know the qualification, you don't know the education, the training background of those people. And we were talking about itinerary workers, but we have a lot of, you know, new forms of employment. So how we can address this issue? That is why the training education is becoming so important, because this new pattern of employment raises new challenges and how we can address to that. And from the ILO perspective, ILO is the International Parliament of Labor. So we are trying to create international legal treaties. In the ILO jargon, we call it international labor conventions. So in the field of radiation, we have a convention, 115, which really is legally binding for member states if they ratify this convention. And the last ratification was done by South Korea in November last year. So this convention covers the protective, preventive measures and other issues. Specifically, there's an article about the training education of the workers. The Article 9 is specifically mentioned that all workers engaging in radiation work should be adequately instructed. So they have to know how to do their work in a safe manner. So that is spelled out in the international legislation. And all the safety guides or safety criteria or standards formulated by the IAEA in collaboration with the ILO all include important element of training and education, because that is so important to make sure the work is being carried out with the workers in a safe and healthy manner. And this was also an issue identified by the professionals, by the regulators. You know, IAEA organized a conference in collaboration with the ILO and other organizations in Geneva, and which made a proposal for the international organizations to carry out international action plans on occupational radiation protection. And you will see one of the priority area is on the training, education of the workers. And we know the BSAS has been revised, and IAEA Board of Governors endorsed the BSAS in last September. And ILO Board of Governors, we call the governing body, officially endorsed the new BSAS in March. So ILO take the BSAS as the basis for the promotion of the ILO Convention 115. And now if you go to the BSAS, you will see the training education of workers have been specified in a more detailed, more precise manner. For example, the government should ensure the requirement is established. That means you really need to have the requirements in the regulations, in the policies. And the regulatory body has to make sure that the requirements are applied. And then the registrars, licensees, the employers, they do have an obligation or responsibility to make appropriate arrangement and to make sure the training for the workers are provided. The training is not only one time, it's also including on-job training or continuous training. So therefore, the employers, registrars, and licensees, they are the one to provide training, education for the workers. And the training should be targeted to all the working situations, not only in normal situations, but in the emergency and so on and so forth. So it was very, specifically mentioned in the new BSS, and the training should be properly recorded. And of course, it has been emphasized in the new BSS, the worker really has obligation to accept the training. The employer provide the training, the worker must participate and accept the training. So that was this principle was specifically mentioned in new BSS. So really, to conclude in this short time span, a good radiation protection training and education for the workers is important. It's not only for the safety and the health of the workers, really. It's for the smooth running of the enterprise. It's for the safety and productivity of the enterprise. So it is also very important for the environment. Therefore, let's try to see how in a new situation, we have a big variety of labor flexibilities and new contract, people with precarious employment. And this is an issue which really we have to take it seriously. So I thank you very much for giving me the time to emphasize how important training and education from ILO perspective. Thank you.
Thank you, Shengli. Thank you, Shengli, to give us the high-level commitments and obligations. One thing I didn't say, we'll save the questions until the end, if you can. So any questions for clarification or discussion points were saved till the end. Leading on from that, John Wheatley from the IAEA is going to talk about specific obligations and responsibilities of different parties and organisations. John.
Okay, thanks, Phil. Morning, ladies and gentlemen. I think you'll see some overlap with my slides and Sheng Li's slides, but as with all good education and training, it's good to reinforce what you've already learned. So this is a very brief overview of IAEA requirements for education and training, and I focused on who's responsible for what. And we'll be looking at the responsibilities of the government, the regulatory body, authorised and other parties, manufacturers and suppliers, and workers. And since I'm from IAEA, these slides are purely based on IAEA safety standards. So basically, the governments, at the government level, you are responsible for putting in place provisions for education and training services. And this would include ensuring that the regulatory body and its support organisations also have access to these training services. And of course, the government is also responsible for establishing the national requirements for education, training, and qualifications. And it also specifically mentions formal recognition of qualified experts. Now, what is the regulatory body responsible for? Well, two parts. One is for its own staff the regulatory body has to make sure that its own staff are qualified and competent. And this, there's a specific note in here that this is very important to ensure that there is independence of the regulatory body, especially if there is a technical service organisation involved. Now, in relation to registrants, licensees and employers, clearly the regulatory body has to, if you like, enforce the regulations that have already been put in place. But also the regulatory body should verify the competence of individuals. And in the BSS, there is specific mention about the requirements for the medical profession when it comes to education, training and qualifications. Now, what about it's called authorised and other parties. So this would be, what's the responsibility of the registrants, the licensees and the employers? Basically, you need to make sure that your workers and even in some cases the visitors have appropriate information, instruction and education and training. And in some cases you need to make sure that the workers are qualified as well. And in the BSS there are three specific areas that are highlighted amongst general education and training, and this relates to controlled and supervised areas. Obviously training in respiratory protective equipment where that's needed. And also the workers need to be informed about potential health risks from occupational exposure. And there's also a requirement for periodic retraining, and there should be some records so you can track what people have had in terms of training and when it's needed again. Now, when it comes to the manufacturers and suppliers of equipment, there's no specific educational or training requirements, but I put this in because it's very important that the manufacturers and suppliers do provide the appropriate information to ensure the workers can protect themselves. And it's key that this information is provided in the appropriate language. And then the responsibility of workers in the BSS, it's their responsibility to accept the information, instruction and training so they can conduct their work in accordance with the standards. So in conclusion, I just have a little overview of what I've been through. So the government establishes the requirements and makes sure that people can have access to education and training services. The regulatory body has to ensure that its qualified and competent staff can enforce the regulations to ensure that registrants, licensees and employers follow those requirements. And then we have some specific requirements. So workers and emergency responders need to have appropriate information, instruction and training. For radiation protection officers, nothing explicit about education and training, but they do need to be technically competent. Now, clearly someone can't be technically competent unless they have the appropriate education and training, so it's really implicit in the definition. Qualified experts, according to the BSS, need to have the appropriate academic qualifications and experience. And again, it's really implicit that you need to have the appropriate education and training if you have academic qualifications. And then some for the medical radiation protection people, such as medical physicists, according to the BSS, they need to have the appropriate education, training and competence. So thank you very much, and I'd invite you to visit the webpage for our education and training in radiation transport and wear safety. Thank you.
Thank you, John. Thanks, John, for a very good sort of expose of all the rules and regulations. We move on now to the industry perspective. We have Willie Harris from the US, from the Nuclear Energy Institute, and he'll talk about training and qualification of technicians and workers. Willie, please.
Good morning. Thank you, Chairman. Good morning, folks. I'm specifically going to provide an example for training and qualification for the RP technicians and radiation workers at nuclear power plants, and that would include all the radiation workers, those both that work for the utility and those that come in for the itinerant type workers. And I'm speaking on behalf, of the NEA and the ISOE program. The program is specifically designed for the exchange and analysis of information on collective radiation doses, dose reduction techniques, and training. So from that perspective, we're looking at it from an international. While I'll be speaking for the U.S. programs, we do tend to look from an international perspective. Right now, it's the world's largest database of exposure for nuclear commercial nuclear power plants. It's really divided into four technical centers, so we have a wide variety of information available, both from Asia, Europe, North America, and the IAEA. You can see the overall area and setup of the ISOE. It's dictated by the management board and the bureau, and you can see the technical centers, and we work on several specific things, and one of the current projects we're working on is an example for and looking at itinerant workers under one of our expert groups. And the ISOE products off the webpage, there's specifically areas you can look at around annual and topical reports and technical analysis is where you'll find some of this information. And just from perspective of some of the successes and many of the key indicators that we have around individual dose, collective dose, around and events showing a significant improvement from the database, as an example of some of the effectiveness. Now, specifically to the topic of training and qualification of RP technicians and itinerant workers, and I'm going to speak from the perspective of the U.S. nuclear power plants, primarily Exelon Nuclear. And right now, Exelon Nuclear, we have 13 sites, 23 reactors, so we're the largest operator of nuclear power plants in the United States. So we have a wide variety of individuals that we bring in, specifically during our refuel outage period. Our staffing will typically go from 800 at a nuclear power site to over 2,300 on average for our outages. So we in-process a lot of workers to work in our nuclear power facilities. And due to shortages in RP technicians, at least at Exelon Nuclear, during our refueling outages, we've employed technicians from the United Kingdom, France, Switzerland, Sweden, Mexico, and Canada. So we have a lot of experience with training and qualification of these individual workers. And our specific radiation protections, we're trained and qualified in accordance with what we call our National Academy for Nuclear Training. And it's a document that we have that provides the basics for the training. And it also accredits all the other training and operations, technical maintenance, RP chemistry, and engineering programs at all the U.S. nuclear power plants. It's really divided into several specific topics. So for training and qualification of RP technicians, you have what would be referred to as an initial training program and then a continuing training program. And there's various expectations, that are established that for the RP technician. Primarily be the understanding of station policy and procedures, fundamental scientific principles, understanding of the operating and radiation protection principles at these sites, and then an evaluation process to ensure that the trainees have demonstrated both knowledge and practical application of the skills before you release them to do independent work in our facilities. Expectations for continuing training. We have expectations for our continuing training program, and that's to maintain a high level of performance, constantly looking to improve knowledge and skills, and then maintain awareness of the responsibilities for the safe operation of the plant. And that aspect there really looks at a lot of the operating experience that you'll see at the other facilities. One of the key examples or key lessons learned that we like to use in nuclear power plants is, don't be the next operating experience. Learn from the mistakes of somebody else rather than making your own mistakes. So in our continuing training programs, we focus a lot on operating experience and lessons learned from that operating experience and ensuring that we incorporate those into our programs. So just from a high-level perspective, and I won't read all the slides, but it's typically you'll have instructor-facilitated lectures and a significant amount of self-study for the initial training, and a large portion is spent around fundamentals and theoretical training that is incorporated in there. And usually it takes about 40 hours per week, and usually it takes about 6 to 9 months to set through the initial classroom training. Depending on the entry level of the technicians as they come in. currently right now in the United States, and I know there was a discussion in one of the earlier sessions, you know, we're looking to upgrade our RP technicians such that we're using technicians that have associate's degree in the United States, and especially associate's degree in radiation protection, so we're looking to up that. Current requirements right now, initial, is just a high school diploma, but we're looking to improve that. So that's initial training. After that, we do a series of on-the-job training and qualification, specifically focusing on, you know, specific tasks. So it's a task-based qualification for the skills aspect. Typically, you'll qualify the initial in 30 to 50 tasks, and usually it's the senior RP technicians, once you get a certain experience level, they'll be providing the on-the-job training, and then supervisors will actually qualify the technicians to perform the tasks independently. Typically, the radiation protection manager at the site that has the final say is who can work independently at their nuclear power facilities. Qualification for the task typically takes 9 to 12 months. In general, the total time it takes to qualify an RP technician in the United States is typically 2 to 3 years. Continuing training processes, we have ongoing continuing refresher training for the RP technicians. You know, it really includes a refreshing training around fundamentals. I already alluded to the operating experience training around, you know, specifically around prevention of unplanned exposure, inadvertent releases of radioactive material, and causes and contributors associated with alpha industry and other airborne contamination events and other operating experience. You know, typically we use a lot of the databases and the information that's out there around dose reduction, you know, out of the ISOE database and other databases that are out there so that we continue to drive continuous improvement in the training and operations of our facility through the RP technicians. And the duration of frequency is usually it's about 24 to 32 hours per year or per calendar quarter. You know, it's about 1 week of continuing training per technician. Similar requirements exist for any contract technicians we bring in once they're on your site. Switching gears, I'm going to go to the radiation training, rad worker training processes. In the United States, when we refer to rad worker training, you know, that typically involves all the individuals who will come on site, you know, provides the worker training, the knowledge and skills necessary to work safely. It typically or could include respiratory protection training to ensure that they have that understanding of how to use respiratory protection devices, you know, for the workers. Includes the following topics, you know, sources of radiation, types and measurement of radiation, biological effects, exposure limits and guidelines, ALARA principles, dose and contamination control, use of dosimetry, and radiation work permit processes and radiological postings. And this type of training is provided initially, and then there's a qualification period of annually for all the radiation workers. They demonstrate their understanding by completing a written exam, and in addition, there's a demonstrate the abilities of wearing protective clothing, the ability to follow radiation work permits, use effective ALARA principles, and control the spread of contamination at job sites. Typically, we'll have radiation protection supervisors and technicians will provide the training. And typical just for the radiation workers, about 12 hours, all in processing. When you look at the workers we bring in for an outage, there'll be more than just the RP training. There'll be training in industrial safety, confined space, you know, use of industrial safety harnesses. So all in total, it takes approximately 3 days worth of training to bring in a worker, you know, to a United States facility. This was just focusing on the RP aspects, just to make sure you have that overall view. And thank you.
Thank you, William. So obviously a wealth of experience from the industry there. The next speaker is going to be Eduardo Gallego, who will talk about the contribution that can be made from the professional organizations. Eduardo.
Thank you. Well, I'm happy to see that fortunately IRPA has no official responsibility with regard to training, according to John's presentation. But anyway, we think from IRPA that we should help play a useful role, should complement what is being offered by official bodies and other probably qualified organizations. As you know, IRPA is an association of radiation protection societies, and radiation protection professionals belong to IRPA through their societies. So, as an association, we should promote and support, provide networking and guidance to education and training activities of the affiliate societies, if they do it individually or preferably if they cooperate between societies in a given region, for instance. Our societies are not universities, and the education and training activities are not intended for diplomas, but mainly they should contribute to professional enhancement, to continuous professional enhancement. And in general, the activities organized by our societies are dealing with general radiation protection trends or to very specialized topics which cannot be covered by other organizations. In the current IRPA strategic plan, there is a task devoted to developing a strategy plan on education and training activities. And this is linked to one of the objectives, which is promoting excellence in radiation protection professionals. This education and training plan is covering three main lines. First one is the cooperation with international and regional organizations dealing with education and training, like the agency, the European networks on or platforms on education and training, the American Academy of Health Physics, or the cooperation to organize the ITRAP conference series. A second main line is the organization of education and training activities within IRPA itself, like the refresher courses in international congresses or in regional congresses that, like we are having this week, discussion forums during IRPA congresses, trying to get ideas and to interact between societies to get useful ideas. And now we think also that our webpage, the IRPA webpage, should be and should provide a good platform for announcements and for sharing resources between different societies. Apart from that, we are continuously stimulating and supporting education and training actions organized by associate societies, and we would like that they share, coordinate, create networks, and they support young generations as we are starting to do it, I hope, in a more effective way from this Congress on. Yesterday we had the kickoff reception to the young generation of IRPA. So going to more precise actions, we have the refresher courses at IRPA congresses like this. If you have attended any of these courses, you have seen we are distributing questionnaires to participants because we want to know what is their opinion and what are their suggestions with regard to the possibilities to improve these courses. We also are testing this live webcasting of some lectures and some sessions in this Congress, and based on that we will try to do it the same for different training activities. And also we are improving the website accessibility to text and presentations, not only for this Congress but for the regional congresses, and we have incorporated a searching engine to it. So what is going to be new, it is now under beta testing, but it will be ready very soon, in a few months. It will be a database on education and training events, announcements and resources. The objectives are to announce training courses or activities, sharing and disseminating training material and resources between societies in different languages, not only in English, and providing a useful tool for searching within that. We are 45 associate societies, and the number of events every year is probably several hundred all across the scope of our society. So a searching engine is necessary. The potential users would be all the radiation protection professionals, and the managers of this database will be the associate societies through one-person contact. Of course, there will be an administrator for it, and it will be the IRPA webmaster. Apart from that, we are continuing organizing seminars, short courses, summer or winter schools on specialized topics, and we promote the coordination of the different societies in this sense. IRPA could give some sponsorship or at least some, let's say, accreditation to these activities, which clearly and openly look for professional enhancement within the full IRPA family. And key aspects would be promotion through the IRPA and the associate societies, the granting to young professionals, the offering of grants and help to young professionals, and the sharing of teaching materials through the IRPA website. And fulfilling these conditions, and maybe they could offer another additional conditions, IRPA would be happy to back up these activities of their associate societies and to spread more the impact of each activity. We also stimulate the creation of networks within IRPA, for instance, between societies sharing the same language or being located in the same region of the world. And also, they will have a dedicated space in the website. And finally, we are establishing a task group on education and training in order to develop ideas and establish priorities for the implementation of the education and training action plan. And it could be the seat for a new permanent committee that we think from the Executive Council that is necessary for the good management of all these activities. Up to now, the incorporation is open and voluntary, and all societies will be invited to nominate representatives in this task group. The work will be mainly by email, but also the social networks could be used. And just to end and to summarize, we will continue the cooperation with international regional organizations. We continue interacting between associate societies to cooperate by or through this new database that we will open. The creation of this task group, we think it will contribute to increase the number and the effectiveness of the activities on education and training. And we try to stimulate and support the associate societies, especially those in less developed countries that may help some support and backup from the larger societies, which may have more resources and people ready to help. And thank you.
Thanks, Eduardo. So those are our formal presentations. We're now going to invite the panel, and the panel members will also just give us a short view from their particular perspective, which will broaden their perspectives. We'll then take questions, and then we'll have some discussion on the subject matter. So if we can quickly go through the panel members to just make their statements, and if you can go to the podium, we start off with Elena Beglova from the IAEA, who's responsible for the Emergency Response Centre, and she'll talk about the training for emergency workers. Or she'll just give a perspective on that.
Good morning. Thank you, Phil. It was mentioned during the previous presentation that emergency workers is a separate, specific category within occupational exposure workers. And the IAEA and the Incident and Emergency Center considers emergency workers as those who have specific role to play in response to an emergency. And you may see here already that it will not necessarily be those who are occupationally exposed to workers in a normal understanding. It may be firefighters, it may be those who are first on the scene, very often law enforcement. It may be medical people, those who are also called first responders by the terms of the IAEA. And IAEA plays a special role in preparing the documents for this category of people and arranging the training for them. You see on this slide the toolkit, first responders toolkit, which actually comprises different parts. Manual for first responders to a radiological emergency, and one may find there specific action guides for all those categories which I mentioned. Law enforcement, you see here even photos, firefighters, medical, and not only. You may also find here action guides for public information, which may be on the scene, and, well, they may have a role to play within emergency workers' activities. Also public information and radiological assessment. So the document will contain action guides for all of them. Training materials for the 2 weeks course, lectures, drills, exercises, tabletop and field exercises. Portable digital tool, which you can upload for your devices to be used in a peaceful time, to train, to drill, and in an emergency just to remind, checklist, what is to be done and what is done already. And e-learning tools for first responders with an e-learning approach to train all those emergency workers or first responders which I mentioned up to now. We are conducting many training courses by request in this area. If you are interested, please visit the website to see more about these first responders toolkit and also training courses which are offered. Thank you.
Thank you. Next panel member is Madan Rahani, also from the IAEA, but he's going to talk from the medical exposure perspective.
Yeah, I will be speaking with the ICRP hat in this, as Phil mentioned. ICRP, as you know, does not conduct the training courses, but whatever it produces is useful for education and training. The situation in medical science is quite different in the sense that there is a very controlled situation in nuclear powers and nuclear reactor, whereas this is the kind of situation. And there is no other category where there is so much high radiation being handled without education and training of the workers, without monitoring of worker and patients, and so many deterministic injuries reported. Of course, when it comes to education and training, the principles of radiation protection, justification, optimization, all those limitations, all they are very useful and used in the education and training. ALARA principle was developed by ICRP. In medical area, there is a publication brought ICRP 113, Education and Training in Radiological Protection of Diagnostic. It covers who should be trained, what should be covered in the training, how should be it be trained, and how much to be trained. There is a coverage of whether the particular target group needs this kind of or this kind. So one has to have a target audience. ICRP recommendations, of course, are directed at regulators when it comes to the training, authorities making regulations, users, trainers, training, and policy makers. Essentially, it is the competent authorities and professional bodies who have been assigned responsibilities. Thank you.
Thanks, Madam. The next panel member is Anna-Marie Schmidt-Hanning, who will talk about the European Commission or European Union's initiatives in training and education.
Yes, thank you very much. So, in Europe, we have some special issues when it comes to education and training. So, there are a number of requirements in the Euratom Basic Safety Standards with regard to education and training in radiation protection. And there are some networks on education and training in radiation protection and also in other areas. So these are supported by the DG Research and Innovation, and these work together on the basis of the European Qualification Framework and on the European Credit System on vocational education and training. And so you see, it all comes together in education and training in radiation protection, which I would like to specify something about the European Network on Education and Training in Radiological Protection, that is the ENETRAP 2 project. There has been some achievements already in the first Enertrop project, which is the European Master of Radiation Protection, and that is the development of an education of radiation protection expert training scheme and of standardized training material. Now we are in the Enertrop 2 project, and here we have the objective to develop a European approach for specific workers and functions, such as the radiation protection expert and the radiation protection officers in all sectors where radiation, where ionizing radiation is applied. And for the future, we are going to develop guidance documents to support implementation of Euratom basic safety standards requirements on education and training of RPE and RPO. So we want to demonstrate the practical feasibility of earlier developed concepts for mutual recognition of RPEs and comparison of training courses in terms of specific learning outcomes in line with the European qualification framework and the European credit system on vocational education and training. So here you see a simplified overview of how many, many projects, networks, and studies are going on to support the EU basic safety standards, to support the implementation of the requirements for radiation protection education and training. So you see, it's not a simple task, but we are all trying very hard to provide the necessary guidance to help the member states to implement the requirements for education and training. Thank you.
Thank you. Don Kuhl from the US NRC will talk about knowledge management in this area. Don.
So good morning. Glad to be here. I'm going to change the viewpoint just for a little bit. Of course, there are regulatory requirements to do the various activities and provide training for people who are coming in. Logically, it should be a systems approach that analyzes the situation, develops the objectives, designs the training on the basis of those objectives, and then evaluates their performance. But you know, it's not a pile of books. The real question becomes, have you passed on the knowledge in a way that they can actually use it, and their performance is what you're looking for? So have you passed along that knowledge? Have you passed along the bad traits or only the good traits? Because unfortunately, people tend to learn the wrong things sometimes when they follow along from someone who's mentoring them. Have you captured the lessons learned from various activities and issues? Do you have continuous education and improvement? Are you reinforcing the safety culture traits that are out there? Are you actually thinking and challenging as a result of your education? We have had in the United States over the last 6 or 7 months, unfortunately, a cluster of overexposure events in industrial radiography. Now, I can't tell you that I know for sure what all of the implications were underneath those, but I can tell you that several of them occurred with individuals who had been on the job less than a month. And somehow the thought that they didn't know that they should not drape the guide tube over their neck as they climbed down the scaffold with the source still in the guide tube leads me to wonder to what extent we're actually passing on knowledge in a way that someone will be able to use it. But at least for us in the regulatory community, and I think across the whole boundary, knowledge management has another facet. For those of us who are now in the grandpa generation, who's going to carry on when you decide to go someplace else? Are we building the expertise, are we building the competencies that will be able to lead the next generations on? And that, I believe, is our greatest challenge. Thank you.
Thanks, Don. And then finally, Jean Koch will give us a perspective from a research organization in terms of radiation worker training. While Jean's walking there, after this little presentation, all the panel members to come to the front, please.
Thanks, Jean. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm a research scientist at the Radiation Safety Division of the Sorek Nuclear Research Center in Israel, which is a R&D organization, but which is also running the only training course for radiation protection that we have in the country. So our training institute is mainly having a course for radiation protection officers, which is a six-day course in which we teach about 250 people per year. But our radiation at work regulations also require all employers of radiation workers to provide an annual retraining or refresher course, I called it. And this is generally the task of the radiation protection officer, but we are also deeply involved in the, in this activity, since we provide this service to about a quarter, I would say, of all the radiation employees. The training institute also runs one-day professional visits for two kinds of public, for high school students and for the general public through professional associations. And here the purpose is to initiate them to radiation uses, and to radiation protection. In recent years, there should have been a third slide. Anyway, I would say that in recent years, we became deeply concerned with the public perception of radiation risks, of radiation and radiation risks. And in an era which is characterized by the massive use of non-ionizing radiation through the mobile telephony, we find that in the public discourse, many are not even making the distinction between non-ionizing and ionizing radiation. So I would like to emphasize here the special role that our training institute is playing in disseminating, I would say, correct and trustful information about radiation, radiation risks, and radiation protection, and therefore trying to change the public perception on those issues. And here we mainly use the courses for the radiation protection officers, since this is, as I was mentioning, a six-day course and in which we try to build trustful relations between the trainers and the trainees. And the trainees generally consider the information they receive as trustful. And then we rely on them to disseminate the, that information in their organizations. Thank you.
Thank you. Can I invite the panel members and the speakers to come and sit at the front? We're going to take questions now on the presentations or the views. So if anyone has any particular question, please now ask the question. And then we'll go into discussion. And just to remind you, the four areas that we thought really we should try to focus on is who should evaluate the adequacy of training and what should be the criteria in that regard. Really, are the responsibilities for itinerant workers, the migrant workers, adequately established? And is there any utility of a passport, a skills passport, for workers who are sort of moving around from different sites? So those are the four areas we thought we should focus on. If people think we should focus on other areas, please identify that. But now the chance is yours to ask questions from the speakers and panel members. Questions? Is it so easy? There, over there.
Julian Hilton, LF Group. I had a question just reflecting on something that Roger Coates said yesterday, which was whether professional training and stakeholder training should be separated. Reflecting overnight, I wondered whether that was true. Just to invite comments from the panel, having such an interesting group of speakers. When the same issue came up in clinical research in the 90s, when patients in clinical trials were being killed because informed consent procedures were failing, it was recognized that it's certainly around informed consent, training the physician to do studies properly and training the patient to understand what was concerned or the patient's representative in getting in the study was regarded as the same task. In mining, we're now beginning to understand that the social license from the stakeholder is a fundamental to a sustainable mining project. Are we at the point in radiation protection where something equivalent should or could be discerned from the training program, such that the interest of the professional and the interest of the stakeholder is equally recognized around a common body of knowledge that perhaps might then enable stakeholder acceptance to turn the corner.
Does anybody wish to respond? I think a rather complicated issue.
Well, I think you have answered the question yourself that it's both, involvement of both is there. So the only thing I like to say is the awareness on the part of stakeholder. For example, when we talk of patients, really it is awareness and that provides feedback to the professional. So certainly the training of professional and a good awareness for the stakeholders creates a feedback loop which really is useful.
I just wanted to add, for instance, the role of IRPA societies with regard to this, I think it can be also very effective. We have the example in Spain. Our Spanish society have prepared a different formats of informed consent on radiation procedures to patients. And can you believe me that this is a best hit on our webpage? It has been thousands of downloads, and many hospitals are taking it as a reference. So I think it's an indirect way of training physicians and doctors. But I think the society should take a role in this also.
Yeah, please.
Since informed consent issue was brought in BSS, there was a lot of discussion on information to the patients or informed consent. The agreement was on information. Informed consent has legal connotations, and that has many complications. You cannot expect for every CT scan or every radiological examination to have paperwork which anybody will sign without any reading and other. So what is ultimately agreed upon in BSS is information, and that information also in an understandable manner, and there it has to be recorded that it was conveyed and the person has understood. That's enough, not the informed consent to be signed by the patient. So, maybe in Spain you have been successful in that, but...
We prepared suggested format, then the hospital adopted.
Okay.
So it's not our society who prepared the legal document, just the suggested format.
Okay.
Any more specific questions? Yeah. It's coming.
Thank you. I'm Helene van Elsegger, working at Energy at the Netherlands. I saw in all of your presentation that you spent a lot of time of tutoring and courses for radiation workers, radiation protection officers and experts. And I think one of the most important things, apart from training them, is to train the management in radiation protection awareness. We also call it a radiation protection culture, but to have them to have some knowledge, not very solid, but just some knowledge about what things are going on in radiation protection, and I would like to hear your views on that.
That's quite an interesting point. Anybody, Willie, do you want to maybe address that one?
From the perspective of how we train in the nuclear power plants, our management staff is considered to be radiation workers. So everybody from our CNO all the way down will go through the rad worker training. So they'll get the same basic knowledge requirements as every rad worker that they would have. Now that gives them a base level of knowledge. Now a couple other things that we specifically do, and I'll speak from the viewpoint about Exelon Nuclear, is we establish various committees. You know, we call them our corporate layer committee, which is a corporate body, and our station layer committee. And from there, we talk to the various issues in radiation protection, not only dose, but all other aspects of a radiation protection program, so that the management, so that we're looking to establish that culture, that radiation protection culture from the senior management on down, and then look for you know, that senior managers, you know, both from the maintenance, the site vice president, the plant managers then, to help drive that RP culture through the rest of their organization. So, you know, we look for a lot of what we, the term we typically use in the NPPs is line ownership of not only DOSE, but the radiation protection programs. And we use the radiation worker training and the various committees that we have at our nuclear power plants to drive that culture.
What about from the medical area, in terms of sort of training of hospital administrations? Is there any?
Well, I'm not speaking now on behalf of IRPA, but on behalf of
speak
the...
Speak as yourself.
Yes, on behalf of the TransNuSafe. Yeah. It has been included in your slide, yeah. Anne-Marie. TransNuSafe is a European project now trying to develop training schemes on nuclear safety culture and radiation protection culture, both for the nuclear fuel cycle and for the medical application. So it is intended to develop this training scheme for managers. So it's difficult, and we are now trying to develop some kind of training for 1-2 day sessions, no more, because they have no time, but it's very important. And probably the medical field is the most challenging one, because the nuclear field is much more developed.
And what about emergencies? Elena, would you like to comment on that? Because, I mean, it was interesting this morning. I don't know if everyone went to the Fukushima session, but I think one or two of the things that came out there was, you know, difficulties of making decisions at sort of high government levels and local government levels.
To return to the medical sector, I would say that the issue you mentioned is a real issue in the real world, because apart from the nuclear industry, if I'm considering medical organizations in my country, I wouldn't say that the higher management is committed to safety and to radiation protection. And the radiation protection officers have to fight to get funding there in the organizations. So the issue is real, and we should tackle with it.
Yes, emergency area. And it is within the question which was raised. It's both about awareness and it's both about training of the ability to make a decision, which is definitely critical in an emergency situation. When I presented shortly what agency is offering with regard to training of emergency workers or first responders, it's not only separately what each of them should do. It's how to work together and it's how to work within the incident command structure. There is always someone in charge. And when we provide this training, one of the objectives, the scope of some lectures and field exercises is to train this quick decision-making process, to make people aware in advance that it should be set, and then to drill and to train this process actually against the specific time scale. Because there are objectives to be able to make certain decisions within a certain period of time.
There was another dimension to the question, was safety culture. I mean, when people spoke, there was a lot about Sieverts and Becquerels and so on. What about the whole cultural approach to safety? Is that an issue that's lacking a bit in training of workers and managers? Anybody wish to comment on that part of the question?
I think the whole question of safety culture is one that is growing and evolving. You mentioned radiation protection culture and various other cultures. I think many places we're only beginning to realize the importance of the culture all through the organization, because it does not make any sense to keep pounding on the line workers, you need to do this safely, you need to do this safely, if they don't sense that their management team is ready to support that sort of decision. How do they see it? Do they see it in verbal support? Do they see it in behaviors? Do they see it in money?
John, can we just give John and then back down to Shengli? Okay, Shengli's one. But you're next, John. Okay. Well, go on, John, you go now.
Thanks. In relation to Helene's comment about sensitizing senior management, and it's also linked to safety culture. I'd say don't set your sights too low, also look at ministerial level and governmental level, because certainly at the agency, many of the countries we deal with, they're struggling to establish a regulatory body In some cases, regulatory bodies' fundings are being cut right back. And certainly from the agency perspective, there are cases where we've sent quite high-level missions to some countries, so either directors from the agency or even deputy director generals, to go to meet ministers in some countries where we know, for example, that the ministers decided to basically cut all funding to the regulatory body or to cut it down from 20 people to just two or three. So again, it's not really education and training, but it comes down to what we'd like to call sensitization. And certainly a few years ago, our previous director, Ms. Amaral, she organized a meeting for many of the ambassadors to the agency. So we had the ambassadors come to the Vienna International Center, and again, we sensitized them about how important radiation protection is, how important radiation safety is. So you need to get the buy-in from the very top level in the country, not just senior management within the company. Thank you.
Thanks, Shengli. And then we'll take more questions.
I just try to add, based on June's intervention, and training education should be interpreted in a broader way when we talk about the management. Talking about the safety culture, I just try to brief you because we have a session on radiation protection culture and safety culture in the nuclear industry or in radiation. But from the ILO perspective, we emphasize safety culture in the following ways. The number one is that it is a right-based issue, which means all the cultures should reflect that the workers has a right to work in a safe and healthy working environment, which means the employers has obligations for risk management, you know, risk reduction, and so on and so forth. That is the first element in ILO work on safety culture. And the second element in ILO's work in relation to safety culture is participation approach, which means if you do any radiation protection or safety and health in general at the workplace, and you can't do it solely by the professionals, but the radiation protection officers, or the experts, or the managers, you really need to involve all those people. So some people call it the stakeholder involvement, but from the ILO perspective, we really promote the participation approach, which means you have to involve the employers, workers and the government throughout the process. The workers has to participate in the whole process, starting from the policy establishment to the protection measures, implementation and evaluation, and so on and so forth. So the last point, which is also very important in ILO's work on safety culture, which is about the prevention. All the safety cultures should orient it to prevention. Prevention is the priority for safety culture. So that is the ILO's contribution to the safety culture, and that is taken in the form like a conference resolution to emphasize the safety culture. So even ILO named the safety culture the workplace with the term preventative, just to emphasize the focus of prevention.
I'm going to take some more questions, but if any panel members have got other things to say, we'll try and sort of weave it in to the next response. Mohammed, and then Ted, and then as we go along.
I just want to raise two points. First one is the e-learning. Is it good enough? E-learning, I think it will be in radiation protection without any practical work, any demonstration of how to use instrumentation. Is it good enough for e-learning to be good enough for radiation worker to carry on work after that? Second point is the problem of the duration of the training course. We have been taking, for example, the IAEA basic course in radiation protection for many years, and with many subtitles, basic physics, dosimetry, health effects, etc. We teach it in 5 weeks. 5 weeks usually is so too much, and I believe IA further made it in 4 months, then in 9 months, I don't know, in Syria and in some other places. So we would like to know what is the proper duration for basic radiation training course, radiation protection training course for a radiation worker.
John, I think that's same to you, but also Anne-Marie. How much and how much is good enough and adequate?
Okay, e-learning is mainly used in Europe for refresher courses or to bring people up to a certain level before a training course starts. So that is actually the main objective. And also the question about duration. In Europe, we are more and more now following the European Qualification Framework, which is not talking anymore about the duration of courses. So it's more the learning outcomes which counts. That is the important thing if you try to build competence. You build competence in terms of knowledge, skills, and attitudes. And that is really important. We have to come to this qualification framework to make qualification more transparent and more comparable also in the world. I would say I could see a good chance to explore whether we could use this European qualification framework on a worldwide scale, and that is also a question to the IAEA and to ILPA, whether that is a good idea to make on a worldwide scale qualifications more comparable.
Training for each individual, because in a class you have variety of basic qualification, you know, variety of persons with different backgrounds, but they are working either in a medical or industrial or in other applications. Is it your training is for individuals who train individual by individual or in a class?
The e-learning is a very good tool just to bring people up to the same level.
John, did you want to comment on this one?
I could just briefly add, I agree with Anna Marie about the e-learning is a useful supplement, but I can't see it ever replacing actual face-to-face teaching. And certainly when it comes to the competence, you certainly can't do that through e-learning. A bit like trying to learn to swim by e-learning. You need, at some stage, you need to have some practical experience. In terms of, you mentioned about the postgraduate course, the basic training course. This is a 5.5 month course, and it is a postgraduate level course. And many of the universities we work with accept it as credits towards a master's degree. So we can't really compress it down to five weeks. We already get complaints from the students that 5.5 months is not enough.
I'll comment on e-learning, and again, typically we use as a variety, as one of the tools in the toolbox for providing that. It's typically used for requalification, you know, but on that, you know, there's other aspects that you use, you know, for the transfer of the knowledge. I think a lot of it, when you use an e-learning program, comes into the actual demonstration in the field, and that's where you have to rely on your professionals who are out in the field to make sure that the workers and the RP technicians or whatever aspect you're using e-learning for are demonstrating the proper behaviors, demonstrating the proper activities. But not only that, when they're seeing a worker, you know, not doing that, that they actually provide the coaching and reinforcement to them when they're out in the field. Now, that is a vital aspect of if you're going to rely on e-learning. You can't forget about that in any type of program or training program. That you have to have that piece of, you know, on-the-job training and corrections in the field. If you forget about that aspect of it, then whether you use e-learning or any other type of training to try to pass on skills and knowledges, if you're not actually following it up in the implementation aspects in the field by supervisors, managers, and coworkers, most training programs are going to fail.
Ted.
Thank you very much. One of the things that I've taken from all these presentations is that there's an enormous variety of very high quality training material that's out there, from the on-the-job training all the way up to the manager training and the minister training. And it's being done in a variety of ways at the IEA, at the European Commission, in individual organizations at the ILO. My question is based on what Don said about how do we make sure that this is sustainable. If in the end, it seems like the future of all this is going to be on the cloud, on the web somewhere. But how, if I go to Google now and search, how do I train to do this? I'll get a zillion hits. How do I know as an individual in a company or at various levels that this is the right stuff, that it's the right information, because you can go to Google and find anything from real garbage to real good stuff. So what is anybody thinking about how this might be, I don't want to say certified, but agreed, other than having an IEA label or an ILO label, what, because the IEA doesn't have training material all the way down to the floor of the shop. That comes from Exelon, that comes from other places. How do you know that something is good, and how can we certify that something is good on the web to make sure that it's sustainable for the future?
Yeah, I think that's very important. When we started the discussion, I mentioned there were a few things that few sort of topical areas we wanted to look at, and one was, you know, what's the success criteria? How do we do that, and who should evaluate it? So can I ask the panel in responding to this particular question to sort of maybe bear those points in mind, is how do we evaluate the goodness of the training, and who should be doing that? Is it the regulator, the employer, is it the union? Who should actually be doing this? So maybe if you can try and address those two points in response to this particular question, is how do we know that all this training is actually good? Does anybody want to take that one?
I'll speak from the process that we typically use in most of our United States. We use a systematic approach to training as part of our evaluation, you know, which involves, you know, various aspects, you know, analysis of a task, the design of the task, the implementation of the task, and then the final aspect is a feedback loop around evaluation. And, you know, typically you'll see that evaluation aspects and, you know, on-the-job performance. You know, are you getting out of training what you expect? And so part of the evaluation, you know, is the program good? You know, you establish pre-training, you know, what are my expected outcomes of the training, and did I meet the training? Then you use a feedback loop both from the results, the individuals who are in the training program, you know, to capture and document that. The follow-up aspect is in the United States, we have what we refer to as an accreditation and a reaccreditation process, you know, such that every 4 years, you know, all of our training programs, you know, the ERP technician training program, the maintenance training program, they get reviewed and evaluated by, you know, the National Academy of Training. You know, do the programs, you know, still meet the requirements of the accreditation, and are they effective and good programs? You know, the effectiveness is determined by, you know, here's our outcomes, you know, we expect, you know, this type of improvement, and you know, then follow up to make sure you got that type of improvement. And then each year, that, you know, every 4 years, you know, part of that accreditation is you'll go down to, you know, Atlanta, and you'll actually go through an accreditation board where, you know, so for example, you know, myself, you know, I've been through three of those accreditation boards. You'll go sit in front of, you know, people from academia, you know, other industry leaders, and essentially it turns into I'll call it a 4-hour grill session, you know, about your program. So believe me, when you go down and talk to those folks, you want to have a good program, you want to be able to communicate that, but that's just, you know, one of the processes that we use, you know, in the States, you know, to answer your question about how you know that the program is good, you know, relative to, you know, how we do it, especially RP technician training in the States.
Yeah. Mana?
I think Ted's question excluded the like IAEA or any source. If you exclude that label part, then it is the market forces. These days, we are living at a time when you do the Google search, nobody goes beyond page 2. In fact, not even page 2, page 1. So nobody wants to see whether this is certified or uncertified, page 1. And that's it, number 1. Number 2, Wikipedia is the best example. It comes on page 1. Everybody finds it trustworthy. It's not something which is among the category of conventional peer-reviewed. Anybody can make change on any Wikipedia page. So a few years ago when I had to answer this question, I will say, oh, from a peer-reviewed source, peer-reviewed journal, we should trust only that, not from anywhere. But I think the world has shown that an open source like Wikipedia can be trustworthy, where anybody can make a change. So it is the market forces which are driving the things and bringing the things on in that rather than accreditation and certification processes. Thank you.
And Elena?
Yeah, thanks. About emergency area, and here I will be talking not only about emergency workers, which was a specific subject of this forum, but also now I will cover any activities the agency and incident and emergency center is doing with all involved in emergency preparedness and response. I want to stress 3 points. The first one, how do we ensure that it's a good quality product? And how do we ensure that it's actually one voice message from the international community? I guess it was briefly mentioned in John's presentation about safety standards of the agency. So whatever we do in EPR area, and I believe it's valid for other areas, it's driven from the safety standards. And safety standards are co-sponsored by many international organizations. Moreover, the documents and training materials which we develop, some of them are also co-sponsored by international organizations. When I presented a toolkit for first responders, actually the document was co-sponsored by WHO, PAHO, and the International Organization of Rescue Services. So here is actually the measurable quality of one voice message and quality. Second item about the process. Agency is trying to do train the trainers as much as possible. This is sustainability. Was raised in the question. And like in EPR area, we are helping member states which are interested to build so-called capacity building centers in EPR. By doing this, it's also sustainability. And the third, we are oriented to the outcome of the learning process in line with what Anna Marie is saying. There is a pre-test and review test at the beginning of the end of each course. And there is a comparison based on numbers from where people are coming into the course and with what they are leaving actually. And well, we are pleased to see the increase in the rate of the answers. And it is, you know, it's without names on it, so we can't actually make it biased, even if somebody would like to. It's unbiased assessment, which is based on numbers. 3 items, thanks.
Shengli, brief comment.
I just want to see briefly 3 points. Number one is that really the how does to judge the information on the web is authentic or good or scientific or whatever, it should be judged by the purpose, how you are going to use that. There's no unified standards, really. It's depending on how you are going to use the information. So Wikipedia could be very useful for some people, but may not be, you know, considered as junk to other people. So really it's linked to the purpose and application. The second point, I want to see that the accreditation, in the workplace, it certainly has some discussions, provoke discussions. For example, how you classify a worker in a way. Certainly for service providers, you need to have qualifications, you need to have certifications. But in the workplace, how that is going to apply for the workers, that is another issue which provoke discussion. And the third one is really that the misuse of this accreditation in a way that, you know, it's becoming a commercial or market tool for people, not really for safety and health or workplace in terms of radiation protection and safety, but really it's becoming a commercial thing. You know, you show to the outsiders, I have the certificate, I have this and I have that, but that really is not a true reflection of the performance in terms of safety and health. And this is also linked to another aspect of the issue is how does it the fairness in the workplace? You know, we have a heavy pressure of unemployment, and then, you know, those workers with a high, you know, diploma, high level diploma or certificate, and how about the other workers? Because in the workplace, it's really what is important is that you can do your work. It's not really how many diplomas or certificates you have. So all these issues need to be considered.
We've got a few minutes left, about 5 minutes left, and I would like to sort of try to get the panel to summarise a few sort of dimensions here. But before we do that, we'd like to have a little bit of audience participation, because a very interesting point's been sort of raised here is who do you really trust in this thing? Is it the organisations, the ILO, the IAA, and unions or whatever, professional bodies? Is it the employers who are providing training, or is it the regulators that really do the independent evaluations and approvals? Could we have a show of hands as to who thinks which of those groups really is the most trustworthy that you could put your trust in as a worker? Who thinks that the organisations, IAA, ILO, IRPA, is really the entities that we should be putting our trust in terms of sort of saying this is the kind of training and this is how we want it evaluating? the employers who have a direct responsibility, or the regulators who've got this independent responsibility. Can I have a show of hands for who thinks the most trustworthy group there are the organisations? The IEA, ILOs? Not bad. Not bad, yeah, about 60%, eh? About 60%? 50? 53%? Anyway, okay. The employers, who thinks the employers are really the ones with the competence and the... Ah, Sylvain does, yeah. Who thinks the employers are the most trustworthy? One, two, three, no. Oh dear, Willie, you've got a bit of a job to do that. Who thinks the regulators? Nobody. Oh, the regular. Okay, not so many. Come on, who supports the regular? I was a regulator. Come on, guys. So that's very interesting. That's quite interesting that the majority of people think the organisations, IEAs, ILOs, and sort of professional bodies, maybe are the more trustworthy sort of elements. I think that's an interesting. I'm going to invite the panel members to respond. What I'd like you to do in responding, because we did say we want to try and give some pointers for the way forward to these different organisations, maybe. Try and give us some sort of pointers on the way forward in terms of, you know, the training, its evaluation, what we do about people moving around from one site to another, and what about this idea of a passport, a skills passport. If you could try, if each panel member would just respond on those points, bearing in mind what you've seen from the audience. Don? I can see you bursting to respond.
Well, I was actually reflecting on the question that you had just posed there, and I didn't vote for any of them, because the one that I would be trusting would be something different. Because I think what you left out is a very valuable part of the system, which is an independent accrediting organization, where you have peer-reviewed groups that come in and look. You have that in the nuclear power industry in places. You have that in the hospitals, the joint accreditation organizations and otherwise. And I would suggest that that is another location that can be looked to in a situation where there may not perhaps be the trust of the regulator, although I'm glad we had some people vote for the regulator, or the international agencies or the employers, that they need to work together to formulate what's a solid program. And I actually think that having reviews done is a key component of that. We do reviews on ourselves. We have a program, I know we have at least a couple of the folks from the US here who are part of our state's program. We even do review programs of our own programs back and forth, having our states and ourselves do review processes to see whether or not we are performing the way that we need to perform.
Thanks, Don. I'm going to start at the end now. Shengli, if you want to respond in general and bearing in mind the specific question.
I certainly, like Don, I did not raise my hand because I was confused about the question. in a way that, the certification is always done for a certain purpose. If you talk without mentioning about the purpose, and people can understand totally different. Number one. Number two is that different countries have different situations. For example, in some countries, people have a lot of trust to the regulators, to the government for certification. But in other countries, you know, when civil society is very mature, so people really have trust to the independent bodies. And here we are facing a world audience, and that situation need to be accommodated.
Okay. Willie?
I've got a couple thoughts, at least as far as like a passport type system. I think something like that would be valuable. We have something similar in the United States for a lot of our workers that go from site to site. I would also like, you know, at least in one of the aspects we're taking in the United States is the encouragement of a common, what I'll term as a qualification, you know, what makes a specific level. I think that, you know, we could drive for something similar to that so that, you know, when you look at the various positions at any one of our, and I'll speak from a nuclear power plant, that you can be assured that the individual in that position has, you know, a basic level of knowledge, and that's one of the things we're working on in the United States, you know, to drive that level of understanding. And then I guess the last thought that I would just like to close with is, you know, you have education and training, you know, that's really done in the classroom. I really think, you know, a key aspect of any of these programs is, supervisory oversight and supervisory demonstration of the behaviors in the field. And I really think that is one of the key aspects that a lot of folks don't reflect on when you talk about training and qualifications and performance, is it's the actual in-field oversight of the workers and the behaviors that the leaders are demonstrating when they're out in the field that really helps to drive and enforce any training program. Or otherwise, all you have is a collection of folks sitting in a classroom.
Yeah. Mother?
Some kind of skill certificate should be there. Who should give that? Computer. It should generate when the person goes through some examination. The independent organization at the higher level should oversee the training systems which the computer uses.
Thanks. Reflecting on the audience, well, thanks for such overwhelming voting for International Organizations Trust. It brings definitely additional responsibility to us, but I see it as a joint effort, because whatever international organizations develop, it is with the input of operators, regulators, I don't know about independent bodies, but I presume as well, because member states are involved. As for passport skills, from emergency area experience, it's a must, because whoever is working in different areas in an emergency, skills should, passport should exist, and appraisal of these skills should be in place. Who should do it? At our courses, as I said, one can use this pre-test, review test as a background for the passport skills later on in a country. Who should do it in a country? Here I would refer to a very nice summary slide of John, where it was going up from the responsibility at the national level and then to regulatory body and so on. So it should be along this line.
Eduardo?
Well, I think it depends on the level of education or of training you refer. If we refer to licensed people, licensed workers, I certainly think it's the national regulator who has the responsibility. If I look to other training, maybe independent associations or professional association could play a role. On the other hand, it is true that accreditation agencies are nowadays being, for instance, very common to approve university diplomas. So we are getting used to go to these accreditation agencies, but then it's the government who recognize this evaluation. So at the end, it's the government or the regulator's responsibility.
John?
Thank you. As was already observed, I think that the situation is very different from country to country. Maybe in Europe it's more similar, but in the world, different countries have different organizations. I think also that the regulator should be in charge, but in our case, in my country, for instance, the regulator, the ministry which is responsible for protection of the workers, has not many competent people at his disposition, and he's relying mainly on our research center to do the job. So he's giving accreditation to our center, and we are considered as a trustful organization and doing the job for him. Thank you.
John?
Certainly from the education and training courses that we run at the agency, in radiation safety, we just give an attendance certificate at the end of a short course. Mm-hmm. But for our postgraduate course, we do work closely with universities. So we have 8 regional training centres around the world where we run these postgraduate courses. And where possible, we run them in conjunction with the university. And the university often will give some kind of credits towards a master's degree. So this is some way of helping the individuals to maintain their formal education process.
Thanks. Anna Marie?
Thank you. I think building competence in radiation protection should be based on learning outcomes in terms of knowledge, skills, and attitudes. So that is the way we are going in the European projects. And there is the European qualification system, which also suggests the skills passport And in the Enetra project, we are going to develop that concept further. So I think that is a very good tool, let's say, to compare different qualifications which were acquired in different countries or on different levels. So that might be worthwhile to explore it on a worldwide scale in the future. Thank you.
Thanks. I can see a lot of people still want to ask questions, but unfortunately we've run out of time. Bear in mind, the IRPA has got this forum now, and there's opportunity, I think, to provide comment and input, and I'm sure IRPA will disseminate that to all the interested parties. So I would urge you to sort of make use of that. Unfortunately, we're going to have to bring the session to a conclusion to try and summarise, a little bit difficult, but I think it's clear why training is needed in terms of radiation safety for workers at both the sort of on the job level and at the management level. There is a lot of there are high level obligations. There are international conventions that address this. There are safety standards, international safety standards. So I think we know the areas to be covered, and I think there's a lot of good material. I get the impression there's a lot of good experience. I mean, if you look at the trends of occupational exposure, it's coming down. I mean, it's clear that the training of people and the actual execution is working. So there are obviously success stories that we can look at. So there is good news. One thing that seems to be emphasised is we've got to look at outcomes. So whatever evaluation mechanism we adopt, we've got to look at what actually happens in reality. And so there are different options to assess these things, but we've got to make sure that they are effective in practice. We must do that. And important that we do pass on knowledge to the sort of next generations, and possibly the passport might be a useful tool in this regard. I thank my thanks to all the speakers, to all the panel members, and to the audience, I think, for a very nice, lively, and informative session. Thank you.